So the deal with animals, I think, is this.
Welcome to The Deal with Animals. I'm Marika Bell, answer zoologist, CPDT certified dog trainer, and an animal myself. This is a podcast about the connection and interaction between humans and other animals.
I love this question. What's the deal with animals?
What do I think is the deal with animals? I think the deal with animals, I think is off. They're awesome.
So what do you think is the deal with animals?
Today, we're talking to Michelle Adderby of Vancouver Island Humane Education Center. We will be discussing human-animal interactions in the context of humane education, play therapy, helping youth grow their pro-social behaviors and emotional awareness, all while maintaining animal well-being during these interactions. Michelle is a fascinating individual with a unique story and lives the life I think many of us aspire to. Stay tuned to the end of the episode for shout-outs and a teaser for the rest of the series.
Would you please introduce yourself and share your pronouns?
My name is Michelle Adderby, and my pronouns are she and her.
Great. And would you tell us about your organization and what you do?
Yeah, so I'm the executive director of the newly formed society called the Vancouver Island Humane Education Center. And we focus on animal well-being, environmental ethics, social justice, human rights issues, and more. 28 acres of woodlands and meadows and streams and many happy animals.
And what is your main goal?
The main goal of the program is to support and enhance social and emotional learning, primarily with kids, but we also offer adult programming. And our education programs are centered around the well-being of animals and cultivating, fostering empathy, compassion, understanding, communication, supporting kids in their own development of self-awareness, self-regulation, social awareness.
What kind of kids are you working with then? What is the, you mentioned you do some with kids and some with adults. What's the age range of kids, and what is your main focus with those kids? Are these kids that are having trouble in school, or their parents have sent them to you? What's happening?
Yeah, so we work with a wide demographic of kids. Some of our kids come through the ministry and are engaging in educational programs with animals, so animal-assisted learning, which is more of a focus on personal well-being, and it's a trauma-informed practice. And then other programs we offer in forms of education are open to children in the community that come through outside programming, referrals from parents, summer camps we organize, one-on-one sessions, group programming. So it's a variety of different options.
Okay. And you said a ministry. Which ministry is that? You're in Canada, correct?
Yeah, I'm in Canada. So family and children development, family and children youth ministry. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. And so what is the difference then between equine-assisted therapy, equine-assisted learning? Back in episode 5, when I was doing a health and wellness series, I talked with Dr. Claire Thomas-Pino, and we talked about animal-assisted interactions primarily. Yeah. And sometimes the differences between that and therapy and those sorts of things. So what is that to you?
Yes. To be honest, it's a very fine line. And so I'm not a registered therapist. My master's degree is environmental education and communication, and I have an extensive background in behavior. So my primary focus with kids is to support them, you know, in the development of their social and emotional well-being and focus on their strengths, creating supportive, caring, and safe environments that allow them to observe animals' behavior, primarily working with horses, and develop strong, healthy, and mutually beneficial attachments, and support them in their understanding of the linking between their thoughts, their feelings, their sensations, and how they can effectively communicate. And this is clearly mirrored in the behavior of the horses as we engage with them. So they get to see firsthand the responses of the horses if there is a moment of incongruency, we can't call it incongruency, between what they're thinking and what they're feeling, and then support them in shaping that behavior and building their confidence to interact effectively with the horses. And so it's mutually beneficial. And it's you know, the primary teachings around this are consent, mutual consent, choice, and control, allowing the animals to have control over their own environments, of their own bodies, and their own willingness to engage in the activities.
So what is the difference then between this kind of interaction that you've just described and someone who just wants to go out horseback riding and enjoy nature?
Yeah. Okay. So first of all, I have to recognize my own bias around that. Yes. Somebody just jumping on a horse and going out to engage mm-hmm. in an activity in nature. I really support the building and developing of relationship between animals and kids. And, you know, I come from a traditional riding background as a kid. That was my experience, as it continues to be today. There is no opportunity mm-hmm. to interact with animals and learn about them on the ground. It is simply an instrumental activity of getting on top of the horse and asking the horse to obey to a series of cues and commands. Well,
yeah, that's kind of what I was thinking, because that was my experience too when I was a kid, is, you know, yeah, let's go horseback riding today. So we'll book, you know, the horseback riding stables and they'll have horses ready for us and we'll go for a ride through the woods and then we'll come back. And it's nice to have that interaction with the horse, but really it is just it feels like a very one-way interaction most of the time. I remember one particular time where the horse was not into it, I believe.
Yeah.
Tried to scrape me off on a tree a couple of times. And I left that interaction with very bruised legs. And I don't think it had anything to do with me. I think the horse was just pissed off and not happy with being out that day or whatever it was. But, and I feel like that's not necessarily that interaction, but just, you know, getting on a horse and going for a ride is kind of how people traditionally have interacted with horses.
Yeah. And, you know, it's a story that I constantly hear from parents when they bring their kids about mm-hmm. their trepidation and their discomfort around horses because of these childhood experiences. I can't tell you how many times I've heard that same story. And it really speaks to our conditioned thinking of viewing the world, natural world around us and our animals as instrumental value only. So it's one way. It is, what is the benefit and what is the gain that I will receive from this interaction without considering the emotional, rich environment of the animals. So, you know, years ago, I was teaching horsemanship, and the foundation of the program was that the kids had to agree to come in and spend 6 months on the ground developing strong, healthy attachments to the horse of their choice before we would ever consider getting on their backs and riding. That was my golden rule. And at the end of that 6 months, a lot of the kids were not even interested in riding. They wanted to continue this playful, engaging, reciprocal, mutually beneficial relationship with the horses on the ground.
That sounds amazing. That sounds like not, again, it's not what people would expect going into a stables necessarily, but people don't always know, I guess, what they actually want when they want that interaction. It's not really about the ride, is it? The ride is more of a, I mean, I hate to use the word dominance when it comes to that sort of situation, but it's a master rider sort of relationship.
Yeah.
And the relationship you're describing is a lot more, as you said, reciprocal, but friendship.
Yeah, it really does become a true friendship. And again, it speaks to this patriarchal conditioned thinking that is about dominance and oppression and control. And sadly, continues to be the norm today in riding stables. Very seldom do I hear of children being able to actually interact and form friendships with their horses before, you know, they're placed on their back. And then, you know, it's even to the point today where we will mask punishment with sparkly wands that are whips. So you see little heart shapes and stars bedazzled in, you know, in sparkles. Yeah, mm-hmm. Right? This is the distorted thinking that we are confronted with today. And it makes it okay. It makes it okay to smack your horse with your bedazzled whip because it's in pretty colors. And we need to, you know, enforce these rules upon our animal friends.
Yeah, that is really disturbing when you think about it like that. You know, I was last summer, I was looking for horseback riding lessons for my daughter who was turning 5 last year. And I was, I feeling around because I have come from a dog training background that's positive reinforcement based. And I know that sort of horse interaction is out there. And that's what I was looking for. But when I called around to the stables near here, I asked specifically, you know, what kind of training do you use? What kind of interactions are the kids having? And I got back the most defensive, you know, like knee-jerk, angry. Well, if you don't think we should be doing this, then why are you even looking? Like, you can't just tell a horse that you're its best friend and then you're going to be able to ride it. Like, blah, blah. She was angry that I even just like asked about the training methods that they used. And she said, if you have any better suggestions, then I'd like to hear it. Yeah. But of course, when I replied with a few suggestions of books that I had read on these sorts of more positive interactions, I didn't really hear back from her again.
Right. Yeah, entrenched. We're still entrenched in this very old systematic way of thinking. And it's permeates through the equine industry. I'm a bit of an outlier, I would say, in the equine industry. I certainly don't adhere to or abide by those old dominant methods.
Animal-assisted interactions, a lot of that I have found has focused on what the humans get out of the interaction. And how do you know that the horse is also enjoying that interaction and not just tolerating it?
Yeah, I love that question. And it's interesting because when I began my career shifting from, those old traditional ways of being with horses, it was like a 360 when I entered the experiential learning world of horses as a means to support people in their own personal growth. But I soon found that it was still built upon these very dominant-based, patriarchal, conditioned ways of thinking. And it was, you know, the activities would be centered around activities that were at the expense of the horse in order for the human to receive the value of that teaching. So we would see distressed, tense, uncomfortable horses that didn't have an option about their participation. That is slowly changing. And I'm glad to say that is slowly changing, where it is recognized now that it's about mutual consent. If this is what we are modeling to our clientele, to our participants, then does it not make sense that equal value is placed on our animal partners and participants as it is on the support and the well-being of our human participants. And so my animals always have choice of whether or not they want to participate in an activity. So most of our activities are done at liberty. And so we will participate with goats, and we'll participate with pigs, and we'll participate with horses and in big open areas. And the animal is free to come in and leave as often or as little as they wish. And so for this models for the kids, the importance of that consent, the importance of choice and community and connection and communication.
So we talked a little bit about where the kids are coming from. Where are your animals coming from? You were mentioning earlier, you just had a baby goat born. Congratulations this morning. Do you breed a lot of the animals there? Are they rescues? Where are they coming from? What are their histories?
Yeah, I don't do any breeding. I think we have more than enough animals in the world that need good homes. But I've got some friends that are living on the property right now, and they have a female goat that gave birth this morning. Many of the animals are rescued. Several of my horses are rescued. Some animals have been surrendered. In fact, this afternoon, we have a little Juliana pig being surrendered to us. And coming from a good home, but just is not a good fit for them anymore. So he'll be joining our family. Some of the horses I have purchased over the years, but without question, apart from the two horses that have been born on my farm, every animal that has come into the sanctuary has required some degree of rehabilitation and support to overcome their mistrust of people.
And we always like to guess where that mistrust comes from. My experiences with dogs, often the mistrust comes from lack of socialization, not that anything terrible has actually happened to that dog, but just that they haven't had very many experiences. Do you find that that's also the case, or do you think that the animals that come from more of that, the label of being a farm animal, are actually treated worse, and have come from worse experiences?
Yeah, that's a great question. I have rescued several dogs in the past, and I would say with dogs, it is definitely a lack of socialization. But again, as it is with horses, it is still this paradigm, this dominant paradigm of oppression and punishment training. Dogs, horses, farm animals. In fact, I would say that I think ponies and horses may be one of the most abused companion animals we have. Because I see this shift happening in the dog world. We're moving more towards, you know, behavioral science and positive reinforcement methods. But the equine industry has a long way to go to catch up to that. And so the horses that have come into my care have experienced harsh techniques and methods of punishment and oppressive training. And so, you know, we misunderstand these behaviors, and what we are seeing or what we perceive in our viewing is our obedient, compliant animals, when the truth is that they are victims of learned helplessness and are shut down. And I see this because in the rehabilitation process, when they're actually given choices of whether to participate, of whether to put on a halter, of whether to receive a saddle, they'll often say no. And they will choose not to participate in those early stages of rehabilitative training. So if I move my body towards her in attempt to get on her back, and she starts to shift, or I see some subtle behaviors that or gestures that, you know, she's not comfortable with this, then immediately I back off. But if she stands quietly And she accepts me in my initial gestures of getting on her back, slowly getting on her back, then that it, to me, is consent. Yeah. And then we go off for our ride, usually just without a bridle and a saddle. And then when she's done, which could be only about 10 or 15 minutes, then she will line herself back up at the mounting block and she literally will plant her feet there as if to say, that's it, I'm done for the day.
So I often hear about dogs who really know, you know, their owner's emotions, and they're responsive to those emotions in a really obvious way. And I've heard that's even more true with horses. But I imagine there are some horses, just like with dogs, that are better than that than others. My dog, for instance, never did anything like that and was very much of his own, you know, interests and could care less what I was feeling about any type of situation. So when you have these various horses and ponies, are there some that really enjoy working with the children and others that are just like never?
Just not interested. I mean, there's a big learning curve with kids, right? And so they come in with very few skills. And my horses are very educated. And so some of them are just intolerant. They get frustrated easily. And so they're not the best ones to engage in these activities with kids. Whereas others are very forgiving and very patient and very tolerant and will accept, you know, sometimes a steep learning curve with kids, but it's always supported and guided. And so if I see that there is a moment of discomfort or escalation in arousal with the horses, then I will bring that to the child's attention and have them reflect on what it is that they could possibly do differently to either re-engage, or I'll say, or I'll bring their attention to their own emotions. So if their arousal level is escalating and they're feeling frustration, then okay, now is a good time to take a break. Let's take a break. Let's put the horse away. Let's go do something else. Let's go for a walk in nature. Let's play a different activity. And then maybe come back and re-engage again if that's necessary, or choose a different horse. Again, you know, the horses, because my horses are so educated and they love, most of them love this work, they will line up at the fence waiting to participate. But a couple of the senior horses, yeah, they'll just probably mosey off to the back end of the field and they're happy on their own.
Yeah, we'll just watch from a distance. Thanks. Yeah,
exactly. And we can also learn a lot just from that observation over the fence.
So with children, and you think going to these more traditional stables versus coming to a stables like yours, you know, what are they learning about animals in general when they're being taught these two different methods of interaction?
Yeah.
And I guess what I'm wondering too is how that then affects the rest of their life and the rest of their interactions.
Well, exactly. That is the imperative part of that statement. I think when kids are exposed to a very traditional dominant model of riding and engaging with animals, then how could that not shape their behaviors in other areas of their life? Where do they learn empathy, understanding, meaningful communication, if it is constantly being modeled to them that the horse is here as a commodity, as instrumental value to abide by what it is that you're asking? And so with this program, children really do learn to foster empathy and understanding, and the careful and attentive observation to body language as an indication of what that horse might be experiencing emotionally. Of course, you know, we can only observe covert behavior, but we can imagine and sense what is, overt behavior. We can imagine what the covert behavior is and what the animal may be feeling based on the gestures of their body language.
Yeah, it reminds me of a, an article I read once that talked about embodied empathy.
Yeah.
And the idea that if another being experiences something that you have experienced, then you can feel and empathize with them in a very visceral way.
Mm-hmm.
So if you watch somebody fall down and scrape their knee, your whole body sort of, you know, tenses and goes, oh gosh, I know what that feels like. That's horrible. And if we teach children to have this empathy towards animals, it actually will help them have empathy towards other human beings.
I think empathy is a learned behavior. But initially in childhood, I think there is this natural inherent wonder and awe of the natural world. I mean, kids tend to just love baby animals, but they might not know how to appropriately interact with baby animals. And so, you know, as we model gentle and kind behavior and interactions with them, and help kids to recognize that animals have many of the same emotions and life experiences that we do, well, then how is that not translatable really into other areas of their lives? And as they begin to develop more critical thinking skills, you know, by the time they're 10, 11, 12 years old, children can think more abstractly and critically, then they can put together these connections and make these connections between engagement with their animals and how does this apply in life. And so all of our programming is designed to develop these skills as they are applicable to life outside the farm.
When you have animals that pass away at the farm, how does that affect children that are maybe, you were saying that your work is, you know, takes past trauma into account.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you deal with that sort of situation for a child who maybe has trauma in their background,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
and make that sort of thing understandable to them?
Yeah. It's interesting because I actually have not had that encounter yet. However, I do have some ideas of how I would support that. And one of the ways that I'm thinking is in these gentle conversations around death and grieving, the importance of grieving and the importance of having these meaningful conversations. So I'm thinking, you know, even extending and carrying this over to what's happening right now in our world with our climate crisis and the anxiety that kids are feeling today. It's so important to talk about it openly. And to have these grief circles, these meaningful dialogues and conversations to create a safe space where kids can just share their feelings and their thoughts and their understandings of this process. And so circling back to the animals, then we would make an altar for the animals. We would have this ceremony for the animal, and share perhaps some fond memories and even make something beautiful to put on an altar for them. Or, you know, the horses are buried here on the farm or will be as they pass away. And so to extend that ceremony into further teachings around, I want to say these teachings of impermanence, but that, you know, that's more of an adult understanding. So I guess it's just the teachings around the preciousness of life and the challenges and the difficulties of saying goodbye to that life.
The connection that children have with their pets. And again, it's so variable between children and between their ages. Mm-hmm. I feel like, you know, what they understand at a certain age, it blossoms and it grows so fast,
yeah,
into an adult understanding.
Yeah.
And knowing where it child is in that range must be very difficult. I have always been had a really hard time connecting with children until I had my own. But even so, I sometimes have a hard time really knowing what is an appropriate amount of information to give to a young child versus, you know, downright lying to them, because I always hated being lied to when I was a kid, or even not being told the whole truth was very frustrating to me. And I hated finding out later when something hadn't been the way that it had been explained to me. Whether that was something I learned in school or something my parents had been trying to protect me from, I was horrified. I mean, why do you go to school if it isn't to learn the truth?
Right. That, you know, that speaks to gentle transparency and age-appropriate information, but it can all be, I think, handled in ways that are gentle and compassionate and tender and honest. I don't think it serves our kids at all, even from a place of thinking that we are protecting them, to withhold truths from them, particularly truths about life and death. Yeah, these are challenging topics, and we can approach them with the utmost care and tenderness, and supporting our kids through these experiences. So kids that I've worked with in the past, what's been modeled to them is a lack of care, a lack of understanding, a lack of empathy. And so animals that come and go in their life, they often don't have those same strong attachments that a healthy, functional modeling would offer. And so, you know, they sometimes don't understand the basic necessities of care for animals. So what an animal needs to thrive. But supporting them in the shaping of truly empathetic understanding. And a lot of this is obviously through modeling. We model care for our animals here. We model through the housing that we provide for our animals, through teaching kids the necessity to feed the animals multiple times a day and to groom the animal. So a lot of reflective and interactive activities that builds upon this understanding to foster empathy.
Children that have experienced trauma and they come to have this interaction with animals, do you find that the animals respond and sort of understand what their role is, or are they just interacting for their own benefit?
I don't think animals have agendas. Based on observable behavior, we can see gestures and indications that the animal is either willing to participate or is not willing to participate. And both responses are an opportunity for teaching.
So a child will learn through a very honest teacher what behavior is acceptable versus unacceptable for that teacher. In this case, that teacher is a horse, but the horse doesn't know they are teaching. They're simply responding to behavior they're either comfortable with or not comfortable with. Can you imagine if we all had teachers that honest?
The animals enjoy interactions based on their past history here at the farm sanctuary. So whatever their behavior is, they know that there will not be any punishing consequences to their behavior. It's just not an option here. I don't model punishment. I don't advocate punishment. And so the joy of engagement and the joy of learning and participating, I think is reciprocal. So with the kids, as they learn how to develop their skills in positive reinforcement methods, so we use clickers, and how the horses are engaging with them and reciprocating in that and enjoy the learning, I can't imagine that it is preconceived or an agenda that the animals have. It's just an organic unfolding. And I never know what's going to happen mm-hmm. in the sessions or how the animal's going to show up today. Or, it's a completely organic unfolding.
Yeah, that's kind of what I'm trying to get at.
Again, yeah.
Not necessarily the inner lives of the horses, but what we're actually seeing with that interaction.
Yeah. So I've got a couple of ponies that came to me a few years ago, and they had their training was extremely harsh. And so they came with a lot of mistrust and a lot of anger. One of them actually displayed anger. The other displayed extreme fear. And interestingly, the kids that show up and participate will be drawn to one of these horses. The kids that are a little bit more out, aggressive or, not, I don't even want to use the word aggressive.
Acting out.
I'm thinking of a scientific term. Yeah, no. I'm thinking of a particular client that I was working with last year who was really unaware of her own anger. And she chose Ginger, my pony Ginger, who came to me extremely angry and had experience of betrayal and punishment and neglect. And, you know, through our conversations and through our activities, this client revealed to me and confided in me in time that these were the same issues that she was also working through. And the visible bond that began to take place between Ginger and this client, and the connections that formed over the length of time that we were working together, really helped support her to help the client support her in recognizing her own resolved anger and recognizing her experiences of betrayal, and that she could simply confide and spend time with Ginger in those very safe, supportive ways. And so I think a lot of the teaching that happened was unspoken. It was less about my interference and guiding and directing the activity than it was about this intrinsic and felt and empathetic bond that began to build between the two of them.
Do you think, or have you experienced children that have come through your program wanting to maintain a relationship with these animals into their adulthood? Or as they get older? I don't know how long it's been, you know, if you have children that have been in the program that long.
Yeah, it's funny because some of the kids that have been through the program, particularly in the horsemanship program that started out developing the relationship with horses on the ground, I will still hear from them and I'll get cards from them and I'll, you know, they'll be asking questions of how are the horses, or they'll reflect on a memory that they had with the horses. So yeah, that does continue. That does continue on.
Nice.
Yeah.
So if there was a book that you could gift to all of the listeners, what would that be?
Oh my God. If you could see my office, I must have like 1,000 books. Okay. So one of my most favorite books is called Braiding Sweetgrass by Robin Wall Kimmerer, if you know that one. But the one
that has come up a few times during the podcast.
The one that I'm reading right now is called The Animal's Agenda. And it's written by Mark Beckoff, who's one of my favorite authors. Mark Beckoff and Mark Rollins are brilliant authors. So The Animal's Agenda, Freedom, Compassion, and Coexistence in the Human Age. And Mark's argument is that we need to readdress our science and our teachings around animal welfare and advance it to animal well-being. And I have always thought this. I think our thinking and our science around animal welfare is very limited, and it's still contained within this instrumental notion that the animal is here for our benefit. And so an example of that is, well, how can we improve the five freedoms within the animal agriculture industry? Or how can we improve the five freedoms within humane education? But it's still confined and limited to what it is that we are expecting or desiring or wanting from the animal. Mm-hmm. So, you know, in our domestic animals, yes, we can provide a stable for a horse. We can feed a horse three times a day. We can, you know, provide these other minimal experiences for the horse. But truly, if the horse is not experiencing a degree of freedom to exercise daily and move their bodies and socialize with other animals and eat as they choose and forage to eat throughout the day, then we're doing them a disservice. And that falls within this scope of animal welfare, but it does not exceed to this idea that Mark is getting at of animal well-being. So I'm only about a third of the way into this book, but I love his argument. And he says here, welfare science is predicated on the fact that animals have subjective experiences, yet many in the field downplay these very same subjective experiences when it comes to implementing welfare guidelines or drawing moral conclusions from their work. So I recommend this book to advance our thinking around animal welfare and to move it into ethics and advocacy, and what truly does animal well-being look like. In my own research of humane education, I see the pillars of, you know, environmental ethics and human rights and animal welfare, but I think what we're missing is teachings around what does a life-sustaining community look like, and include principles and metaphors of what permanent culture ought to be through ecological principles like biodiversity and community and feedback loops and cycling and emergence and adaptation, all of these things that I think are a part of humane education, as well as spiritual growth. And Bill Plotkin talks a lot about his ideas that we are really living in a patho-adolescent society. And what we're missing is these ceremonies throughout childhood and adolescent that prepares us for, in our milestones, prepares us for the next stage of life. And our earth ceremonies and our reverence and wonder and awe, how do we continue to bring that forth into our adult lives? And so in my own thinking of humane education, I include those facets of permaculture principles and spiritual growth.
Would you share an early childhood memory, like a formative memory, of your connection with an animal?
Yeah. Let's see. I think one of the first really powerful experiences for me, I was in grade two, watching National Geographic and witnessing the killing of whales. And it was almost as though this light switch went on in my head. And my childhood innocence was I think I in that moment I think I lost my childhood innocence and realized the plight of wild animals at that time, particularly whales. And so I started this canvassing around our neighborhood to raise money for Greenpeace. And I was on a single mission to save the whales. And I think that experience shaped my behavior in terms of my desire and longing to stand up for the voiceless. I remember after that, I began to defend kids in school that were being bullied. And it continued to shape my behavior and my choices throughout my adult life and my career and in my educational path. And then a few years ago, it all came full circle when I was in, I was at a garden party and I met Rex Wheeler, who is the co-founder of Greenpeace. And I shared with him this story of how this National Geographic episode of these whales being killed shaped my entire life. And I thanked him for his courage and his commitment to doing his part to save the whales.
Wow, that is an early memory to have it be so effective for you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I probably started saving animals after that, in bringing home animals and all, to the dismay of my mother.
It's funny when that light switch finally goes on, and when some people it goes on really early, and then other people maybe don't actually have that light switch until 30 or 40 years old.
Yeah. Yeah.
What do you think is the deal with animals?
Yeah, I think, you know, I think we are facing tremendous upheaval in our world today, and the future is uncertain. And these times are being referred to as the Great Turning by a wonderful teacher of mine, Joanna Macy, and many others are saying this. And the unethical systems upon which our countries have been built, they must crumble. And this distorted thinking and these perspectives with which we view the world and have been conditioned to believe must be dismantled and then unlearned in all categories. So environment and human rights and, of course, animals. So the deal with animals, I think, is this. We must unlearn that animals are here for our instrumental use, to be exploited and exposed to insufferable harm. And we need to adopt perspectives that recognize animals are our kin, as is so beautifully described in Robin Wall Kimmerer's book, Braiding Sweetgrass. And to adopt an attitude of gratitude, of reverence, of awe and wonder that children are inherently born with. And I think that children unlearn this beautiful and inherent way of being in the world by the distorted thinking imposed upon them. So we as educators, and so many other humane educators like myself that truly embody these ethics to protect and shape and nurture children's beauty. And I think it will take kind hearts and courageous, independent thinking and meaningful conversations to navigate our way through these tumultuous times. And to learn from our natural world and to kindle this childlike wonder of awe and observation and engage and interact with animal kin. And to truly understand that there is no separation between ourselves and animals and nature. And we are completely independent upon each other for our life on this planet. And animals have so much to teach us that it's time to pay deep, deep attention.
Thank you very much for that. And thank you for joining me today on The Deal with Animals.
Thank you, Marika. This has been a really lovely, lovely conversation. I really appreciate being here.
That was Michelle Adderby of Eco Wisdom Adventures Environmental Education After School Program in Vancouver Island, Canada. You can find her at ecowisdomadventures.ca. Shoutouts this week are going out to my African listeners in South Africa and Ethiopia. I have questions for you listeners in the Western Cape, Gauteng, and Addis Ababa. Which episodes are you listening to, and what questions do you have about the connection and interaction between humans and other animals? I hope you enjoyed the first three episodes of the series Children and Other Animals. Next week will be a special episode. I will be introducing you to Natasha Matzart, the podcast's new sound editor. And to change things up a little bit, we're going to have a wrap-up discussion about Series 3, Equity and Social Justice in Animal Advocacy. If you haven't yet listened to that series, or there are some episodes that you need to finish off, I recommend going back to those now. They started at episode 16 and are about every other episode until episode 30. You can look at the show notes to be sure you're on the right series, as we ran Series 3 and 4 concurrently over the last few weeks. Or if you prefer, you can listen to the upcoming episode first to get an idea about what each of the episodes are discussing and the takeaways that Natasha and I each had from all of them. I hope you enjoy next week's episode of the wrap-up of Series 3. Until then, what do you think is the deal with animals? If you enjoyed this show and have any questions or comments about this episode or about the podcast in general, go to thedealwithanimals.com. Leave me a message. I will always read them, and this is also a great place to go if you're interested in being a guest or have an idea for a series or episode. And don't forget to follow and review wherever you listen to your podcasts, as it helps us become more visible to other listeners. The Deal with Animals theme music was composed by Kai Stranskoff, and many of the episodes in the series were edited by Natasha Matzart. The Deal with Animals is part of the iRoar Animal Podcast Network. What do you think is the deal with animals?